with episode 634 of The Critical Myth. I am John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and, well, that's one tourist trap I don't think I'll head for.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm not sure if enlistment really is the better choice than prison, but we'll have to see.
I don't know. I don't think that, I think we may have kind of gone about as far as we can with daddy issue stories. Do you think that's possible? No? Okay, fine. We'll just keep going. All right, we are going to be picking up the rest of the content from the week ending the 10th of November. And before we do that, Edmund, I believe that there's some kind of disclaimer that you typically give.
Certainly. We will discuss whatever we feel like with these episodes. So if you haven't seen them, you will be spoiled. But especially for this show, it's been a couple of weeks, and you really should have caught up by now.
You really, really should have. All right, and we're going to go ahead and start off with a show that just missed being in the top three, and that would be Manhattan, Season 2, Episode 5, The World of Tomorrow. Frank attempts to navigate his new place on the hill. Thank you, AMC writers, for moving on to WGN. Yes, this came in at an 8.33. And yes, I do believe that one of you has already been talking about this in the open.
Edmund? Yes, I was talking about it. The pinnacle moment of this particular episode was Frank is sitting in the general's office, and basically the general realizes that Frank is going to be nothing but trouble and comes up with a rather unique solution to how to deal with him. He said he can either go back to where he just was, which was that nameless prison in Texas, or he can enlist as a buck private. And the 13 to 15 seconds that Frank sits there and ponders which is the worst thing to do was a sheer joy for me for this episode. You could almost see the actor going back and forth and said, well, you know, the food wasn't that bad in prison, but geez, I still would like to be here, but no, maybe prison would be good. Actually, it goes back and forth for what seems an eternity, but it's only a few seconds, and I really enjoyed that a lot. That being said, you know, it's interesting that the general chose to keep Frank into this situation where he feels that he could be a fire keg. But it works for me, though, and I really enjoyed seeing Frank do all that sort of manual labor and things of that nature. And at the same time, I guess he's around to bounce his opinion off the other scientists to keep them on track to some extent. I almost view Frank as sort of the general's insurance policy or some sort of safety net in some ways, which is why he wants to keep him there. So, we'll have to see how the show goes over the next several episodes, but I enjoy the dynamic of it, and I'd much rather have Frank in camp than away at a prison. So,
Yeah, it was definitely a really interesting. I mean, especially since Frank hasn't been around that much at the beginning of the season, it was really interesting to see how this played out with his return.
Yeah, and I was also fascinated with this device of using the journalist, who, of course, is. Well, we were talking about potential triangles last episode with Supergirl, and does it seem that on Manhattan we have a real life one going on, or I should say real life in the Manhattan world of Los Alamos, with of course the reporter being his wife's old flame, and now very, very much around. But I was also intrigued that this is a device that was used perhaps most famously in MASH, of having actually the real life reporter Cleet Roberts coming in and interviewing the members of the hospital, using the similar device here. And But what I found particularly intriguing was the way they were contrasting what he actually wound up writing, how it did seem to differ slightly from what was being depicted on screen. He was kind of perhaps somewhat out of guilt, turning Frank into much more of the sort of a single male heroic figure. When you see that in fact he and Helen are the ones actually working on this equation, that he's saying he worked out all on his own. There was some very intriguing commentary on sort of the differences between the reality of the situation and how the history actually gets written later. Really the sort of subtleties and analysis that I've come to expect from this show, because certainly of all the shows we watch, this is one that's becoming the one that not that I watch anything live anymore. anymore just because I can't stand commercials, but it's the one where I will be I almost always will be tuning in that 15 to 20 minutes in so I can get my Manhattan fix every week.
Actually, I want to pick your guys' brain since this is one of the shows all three of us do watch. What is the deal with keeping Frank away from his wife? Is it just punishment?
I can't speak for sure, but at least my opinion was is that it was at least a tacit acknowledgement of the fact that she was involved in a lot of his shenanigans as well, and this was the way to keep them from conspiring together.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's just the way I took it.
Yeah, and I mean, the punishment angle as well, but yeah, it was that's the way I've taken it as well, that you need to keep the troublemakers apart.
Hmm. Okay, so moving on from there, we have also close to the top three, but not quite there. Grimm, Season 5, Episode 2, Clear and Vezin Danger. Nick deals with big changes in his home life as he works to keep his child and Adeline safe. At the same time, the rise of the Vezin continues, and Hank adjusts to a new partner while investigating a brutal murder at an investment group. And this one came in at an 8.25. And yeah, I don't have a whole lot to say about this one in particular, but Gary, it seems like you had a couple of comments.
Oh, I sure did. You know, it seems when they start to have like a new villain, they really shake things up to the show, much as they did two seasons ago when they started to introduce the whole royal angle and everything like that. It feels like this whole Vezin coming out of hiding thing is signaling the beginning of like a new era of this show. We have Juliet gone now. The new baby in the situation that won't be taken away this time around. I get the sense that it's almost like they're writing a new show, and it feels like they did a good job with the transition to this new villain focus, and I really liked it a lot. I don't know if they'll stay there, but I felt like they made this sort of shift very well. You know, Juliet's kind of wrapped up. They pulled Trouble sort of out. I don't know if she'll come back in at some point, but it really feels like they were trying to take the show in a different direction, and so far I like it.
Yeah, I think that you definitely get a sense that they've been reinvigorated a bit by some of the shakeups that they've done, and it's interesting to see a show willing to shake things up as much as they have. Really completely shifting the one of the major relationships. Juliet was a huge character for the first three seasons, and the direction that they've taken for it to feel as it's kind of weird to say, but it feels very natural the way that they've gone. And yet, if you go back to the beginning of the series till now, it really seems really odd that they've gone here, and yet it still works. So good on them to be able to make that kind of change without it feeling like it's just forced, you know, as you were saying. So let's see. Moving on from there, we have Supernatural, Season 11, Episode 5, Thin Lizzy, coming in at an 8. And this one is, Sam and Dean investigate a series of murders at a local B&B that also happens to be Lizzie Borden's old home. When a man tells them he saw a little girl around the B&B at the time of the murders, the brothers realize Amara may be responsible. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Indeed. And yeah, this one came in, like I said, at an 8, and Supernatural, once again this season, coming out pretty strong with another good episode.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, now I'm just going to go through these next couple few briefly, but let me just really, really quickly put this into search. Okay. We have also at an 8, The Originals, Season 3, Episode 5, The Axeman's Letter, and Haven, Season 5, Episode 19, Perditis. So both of those coming in at an 8, so above average. So still going strong for those two shows. But we also have here Elementary is back for its fourth season, a little bit late in the season, but there we are. And it came in at an 8 with its season premiere. So Season 4, Episode 1, The Past is Parent. Season 4 begins with Holmes facing criminal charges in the aftermath of his recent violent behavior and relapse, and his father arriving in New York to fix his estranged son's troubles by any means necessary. Meanwhile, Sherlock and Watson investigate a case in which a woman goes missing and may have been killed by her husband. Hmm. So yes, as I said, this one came in at an 8. So above average. Gary?
Yeah, no, the crime in this episode really sort of took a back seat to what was going on with Sherlock. And of course, we're talking about Sherlock having taken heroin and had that sort of regression and the repercussions that he's worried that his father's going to come, and I'm sure Edmund watched this just for that. And I don't like seeing Sherlock, you know, broken. From the beginning of the series, we saw him sort of build himself back up again, and to see him stumble and fall again, while perfectly realistic and in keeping, I still don't have to like it. I'd like to feel that he's made progress and that he won't fall back as easily. That, you know, Joan doesn't have to live with him anymore because he doesn't need to have somebody live with him. He's worked past that. But nevertheless, I suppose it's a plot device. My personal favorite part of this episode was when Joan and Sherlock are talking about the letter writings. If something, if he went to prison, she's like, "I'm not writing you back letters." It was a humorous little quip that I enjoyed immensely. So that was my favorite part. Edmund, I imagine you enjoyed the scenes with his father the most, or am I mistaken?
I was, of course, highly critical of the way they ended last season. So I was, it was a pleasant surprise for me to come to the table here and realize that yes, I did feel like giving it an 8, but yeah, it was primarily for the introduction of John Noble as his father, and to a certain extent, sort of glossing over what had happened, but the way they were handling it, and at least getting them back into cases, even though they do have this problem with the NYPD, naturally not wanting to have anything to do with someone who's up on charges. But the dynamics between him and Watson, and then the way his dad's arrival is throwing the spanner in the works, basically getting me back into the show after I felt they'd taken this strange left turn that as you say, Gary, just didn't really jibe with the character development they'd had him go through leading up to that downfall. I do know in terms of what we're talking about. I mean, I know there are people in the drug rehabilitation community, you know, who have been have liked that the show does stay realistic. But that really was my main issue at the end of last season, that for this character it didn't really ring true for me. But the way they brought it back, it's keeping my interest when I was I was going in highly skeptical.
Very good, and hopefully they can continue this trend for the rest of the fourth season, because, I think that would probably be a bit of a continuation of where they were picking things back up at the latter half of last season, from what I recall. All right, well, moving on from there, we have also coming in at an 8, Ash versus Evil Dead, Season 1, Episode 2, Bait. A special agent tracks Ash. Pablo tastes blood for the first time in a manic showdown, and a revelation changes Kelly's life forever.
Oh yeah,
yes. And,
the twist you were just waiting for.
Yes, indeed, the twist you're just waiting for. And I just gotta say that the moments that work best for me in this show are, of course, the ones that are just over the top goofy. And the best part is when they come barging into the house, and it just looks like this, you know, typical Saturday night type yes. thing, and they're all just sitting around like, what? And they're trying to explain why they're covered
in blood. Yes.
And the deer exploding. Yes. Yeah, and I had to cut it out with my chainsaw arm.
Yes.
it's definitely, those are the moments that it's just completely knowingly just farcical, and that is exactly what I was hoping for and continue to get from this series. So this second episode lived up to my expectations, or my hopes anyway. My expectation was that it would immediately fall apart, but no, it didn't.
No, not quite. But yeah, I mean, just deliriously over the top, and it does amuse me that of course Spartacus was also on Stars, and compare and Spartacus now it's looking like just sort of artfully stylized blood compared to the geysers and fountains of blood that are getting tossed around on Ash versus Evil Dead. You know, it's like yeah, I think at this point Stars is single handedly making sure that all of the fake blood manufacturers in the country. If their kids are going to go through college, no problem at this point.
No, none at all. All right. Also on the list, coming in at an 8, is Homeland, Season 5, Episode 6, Parabiosis. We'll just leave it there. But coming in, finally, the other show coming in at an 8, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 3, Episode 7, Chaos Theory. S.H.I.E.L.D. unearths a shocking truth about one of its biggest foes, and Fitz helps Simmons recover information that could lead them back through the portal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this one, like I said, came in at an 8. And Gary, you had some comments on this one?
Yeah, I was a little bit under the median average with it. A few things. First off, am I still allowed to hope that Blair Underwood dies?
You got to get over the event, man.
Yes.
Geez, but it's just the fairy still lives. Anyway, that being said, a lot of times Ming-Na's sort of emotional, I don't know, scenes, I guess you'd call it, ring a little hollow, or she's way over the top with them, but this one felt better than most. I enjoyed her discussions with the Blair Underwood character, and I liked it. I felt it was a good mix this time around, where sometimes it isn't. Also, I'm sort of frustrated by not knowing what Coulson's long game is, because I really get the sense that there is one, and I can't wait to find out what's going on with his motions towards this other group. I know something's up his sleeve, no pun intended, but I don't know what it is, but I'm really anxious to find out.
Hmm. Yes, well, I suppose that we'll find those out soon enough.
Hmm. Yes, we might.
Since this was a couple episodes ago. I got to say that right now, at least as far as this episode is concerned, I mean, I'm really, really loving the whole Fitzsimmons thing. They really are finally capitalizing on the fact that these two have a great chemistry together, and just mining the drama and the angst to the nth degree, and I'm kind of loving that.
Fitz is suffering. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
His suffering
is wonderful. It's a punctuation on the fact that this season has had so many great storylines, as far as I'm concerned. So, I'm just really enjoying this season so far.
And at this point, have we sort of conceded that Fitz's mental incapacities are gone? It sure feels that way.
I think that they were slowly but surely working in that direction last season, and I think we finally have that he's kind of found his place again. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that they kind of went there late last season, or at least the kind of established early this season, that he was kind of back on track. But I remember having that thought too, that it's like, boy, he's awfully proficient again. But then again, Simmons wasn't around, and he was kind of forcing himself. He had reason, I guess you could say, to really force himself. He was going in some really interesting directions at the beginning of the season. Edmund, anything to add to that?
No, actually, not particularly.
All right, then we'll move on to The Flash. Season 2, Episode 6, Enter Zoom. Barry engineers a dangerous plan to defeat Zoom, but Caitlin sides with Jay and deems it too dangerous for Barry to engage with the speed demon. However, Iris shows her support and brings forth a surprising ally. And this one came in at an average of 7.88. Henry gave this one an 8.5, saying, as we are now approaching the second act of the second season of The Flash, I don't think Barry had learned or appreciated the value of his support system until now. I think that's a pretty fair way of putting it. But Gary, you had the lowest score this week.
Yes, I did. Which is surprising.
Oof.
I was surprised as well. But, I mean, there were some good points. For example, I'm really enjoying Barry's new girlfriend. He's able to actually enjoy himself and smile and have fun without any worry, angst, or problems about, at least at the moment, about with his double life or anything like that. Even though she doesn't know, it hasn't been an issue yet. So I'm asking, number one, the writers, please do not kill her. And number two, please do not turn her evil. Just those two things. Anyway. That being said, part of my critique about this episode was Wells just keeps beating on Jay like he's some pathetic loser just because he wasn't able to defeat Zoom. You're always taking the easy way out. You don't. I mean, it just. And more importantly, no one's sticking up for Jay in the least. Oh, really? He is a loser? He really sucks? Yeah, he's no good. He's a chicken. He runs away all the time and doesn't do any. And nobody stands up for him or even says, well, we need to hear his side. Nothing. No wonder Jay wants to leave. I would get out of Star Labs, too. Nobody's sticking up for the poor guy. So so I wish that they'd handle that a little differently, at least. But Well, maybe they will. We'll get back to it at some point. I'm assuming at some point in the series we'll actually be over on Earth too to see what's going on. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I'm open to that too. But yeah, good counterpoint there. Very good. Let's see. We have Star Wars Rebels Season 2, Episode 4, Brothers of the Broken Horn. That came in at a 7.75. But then we have The Walking Dead Season 6, Episode 5, Now. The mood in Alexandria is quite grim after a number of setbacks, which might prove too much for the sheltered citizens inside the gates. And this one came in at an average of 7.75 as well. Now, Flacco Jones over on VogNetwork.com left a comment. I found it to be a solid character episode. The only character I can't stand on the show is the mayor. Her performance is so one note, and I'm not too keen on her son either. Still, I liked all the relationship drama. It was a nice step back from all the Walker-heavy episodes the season's had so far. And hey, they got to sneak in a couple sewer zombies just for fun, too. So I guess Rick's hand is going to be okay. Seemed like that was going to be a bigger deal. Yeah, Flacco, that does seem to fit a bit of a tease, sadly.
A tease? They were smacking it in our face.
Yes, they were, actually. they had him check his hand one more time. I think it would have been completely over the top. But anyhow. And again, Gary, you came in lower than the rest of us here for this particular episode.
Yes, I did. It felt like, I don't know, like, everybody in Alexandria, while it was nice that they sort of finally accepted what Rick and the other people had been saying, at the same time, it was just some sort of, like, mute sigh. I don't think I was looking for, like, an Independence Day speech moment, but at the same time, I felt that it was more like they would have picked up the banner rather than just, like, sort of tuck it into their pocket and go walking with it. Just, you know, something a little bit more. Also, again, I was really not happy about Rick's hand, and I've actually read an interview about Rick's hand, and they basically said that, no, they will not chop off Rick's hand, as is done in the comic books, because the special effects to correct it all the time would break the budget. So this might have been an opportunity for Rick to lose his hand, as is why everyone was expecting something when they saw his hand get hurt. But they said Rick is in so many scenes in so many different places that to eliminate his hand would cost too much money, so he will not lose his hand. Even though the actor himself said, "Please take my hand," they said they won't do that.
Hey, Gary, you know what's funny is that when you were describing that interview, for just a second, I thought you said that there was an interview with his hand. Which, I'm sorry, with The Walking Dead and the sheer amount of press that there is around it, it's possible that they would have interviewed his hand just to see what exactly is going on.
I can see now, thumbs up, okay, yeah. No, wave it
off. I thought that this was a fine character piece, but definitely a bit of a step back from what we've seen for a little while, and I know that there were people who were very annoyed that there wasn't more information or hints or something about what was going on with Glenn, because at this point they've left it so open as a quote-unquote mystery that, yeah, you might as well just expect.
Yes, this is Glenn Watch Episode 2.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, of course. What really amused me about all this hand speculation is that if only they had been able to do it, we would have then had three shows in a row we were focusing on with characters with missing hands.
Yes.
It's like, wait a minute, these other two shows can do it. What do you mean you can't do it?
Point made.
Well, they don't have mad money.
No, they're only, you know, one of the biggest franchises in all of TV right now.
On cable television, let alone TV, period, at this point.
Yeah. All right, well, running through the rest of these relatively quickly, I'm not going to do the recaps because, again, I didn't have time to do it in the notes. The Leftovers Season 2, Episode 6, Lens, came in at an average of 7.75.
Yeah, can I just I just have to jump in on this one just to say that, yes, my mark was slightly higher, but that was because I thought that Carrie Coon, Regina King showdown at the end of the episode was absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, yes. Again, The Leftovers being that show that you can't help but watch if you have any interest at all in the characters, but by the time that you're done, you feel like you probably need to sit on someone's couch.
Yes.
Seriously, this show is, I'm amazed by the time that I get to the end of an episode, just how long it takes to get out of your head. Anyway, The Vampire Diaries, Season 7, Episode 5, Live Through This, got a score of 7.5. The Librarian, Season 2, Episode 3, and What Lies Beneath the Stones, also got a 7.5. Legends, Season 2, Episode 2, The Legend of Kate Crawford, came in at a 7.5. And rounding out the 7.5 litany here is iZombie, Season 2, Episode 6, Max Wager. And, yeah, I guess the thing about all of those episodes is that they were perfectly serviceable. They certainly continued the good season that they all those shows were having, but not really going up to those higher echelons that we were talking that the shows that we were talking about earlier managed to hit. So, yeah, they're continuing on, but, hey, they stayed out of the bottom three. There's that. Right?
Indeed.
I will and, say this, though, for iZombie, it seems like that's the show that just manages to stay out of the bottom three all the time right now, which, yes, it means that this season is pretty consistent, but it's consistently a little lower than last year, from what I can recall, anyway.
Yeah, and I just wanted to toss in just a comment about Legends, but actually having nothing to do with the show per se. But given the storyline that they've been spooling out, after I may have cast a little bit of shade at USA for canceling that Mr. Robot episode that I thought was maybe a bit of a stretch, given the real life events, given what's been happening with the daughter in that show and the trip to Paris they are planning, it was no surprise that after the events, the real life events in Paris, that this latest episode was postponed. And I'm sure once we finally see it, that was a very good idea.
Yes, I'm quite positive that it's going to turning out to be a very good decision, because this show does go into some pretty dicey areas.
Yeah.
So I mean, we have referred to it before as TNT's homeland. So mm-hmm. All right. So that rounds out this particular week. But this episode, obviously, not done. And what we're going to do is take a mid-show break. And when we come back, we are going to start with the episodic discussion for the episode for the week ending the 17th of November. So stay tuned. All right, and as promised, we are going to go ahead and move on to the next week in our particular cycle here, the week ending the 17th of November. So some shows that are a little bit more recent, let's put it that way, as we continue to play catch-up. But starting with our bottom three, and this one, unfortunately, a little bit of a constant show that shows up in the bottom three, a contender for the bottom, I guess you could say, and that is Heroes Reborn, Season 5, Episode 9, Sunday, Bloody Sunday. Noah searches for Tommy in a bid to stop a catastrophic event. Meanwhile, an underground group captures Taylor. Erica's dangerous plans intensify. Emily has an unexpected reunion, and a violent encounter separates Luke and Melina. Okay, and as it says here, or as I said, it's in the bottom three with an average of 7.25. Edmund, anything to say about this one?
Certainly. From my end, this was a bounce back from that end of the two-parter because there was actually stuff going on, certainly the way they were there, starting to bring all of the characters together, literally in the case of the ice cream shop, was a jump up to at least perfectly entertaining, rather than annoying me with just telling me what's going on, and also actually having Nathan realize that I have hero's powers, I can actually do those hero type things with them, even though that means we don't have hero around. But I also did. It was a bit of a shock to have the Penny Man, who was a character I was actually quite enjoying as he flitted in and out on the outskirts of the story. Have him taken out, and to a certain extent, it was also just the fact that they are sort of embracing the absurdities more, going for it and having some fun with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that they had that one good action set piece at the end, and then the rest of it I just really wasn't engaged by. But we'll see how it goes. Again, this show just is kind of proving why heroes shouldn't have come back, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. But there we are. Coming in at a dead average 7, we have Grimm, Season 5, Episode 3, Lost Boys. Rosalie is taken by a band of orphan children who are desperate for a mother figure in their lives. After discovering a similar missing persons case ended not so happily, Monroe, Nick, and Hank race against the clock to prevent another tragedy. Meanwhile, Adeline considers returning to her career after running into an old colleague. And considering just earlier this episode we were talking about the fact that this season seemed to be really kind of going strong, then we have this episode in our bottom three. But any comments on that, Gary? You dropped significantly from the previous episode.
Oh, geez, this whole Nick Adeline stuff where they're actually sharing the same bed in the Grim Cave or whatever it is you want to call his new hideout. And I'll miss the old house. I like the old house. I'm sorry to see him move out of it. But, I don't care. As they said, we've been through a lot already. Yeah, we sure have, but not that much. So I just can't figure out what's going on with Nick. And then the whole kidnapping just seemed like it played on a lot longer than it needed to. It just really stretched out. So, weak plot B and plot A, I'm scratching my head wondering why is Nick setting up house with this woman like this? So we'll have to see. But I wasn't thrilled with this turn of events.
I just felt like the plot with Rosalie was just a little too obvious where they were going with all of that. But there we are. Huh. Yeah. But surprisingly, coming in at the bottom of our list this particular week is Doctor Who Series 9, Episode 9, Sleep No More. Footage from the wreckage of the Le Verrier space station yields a terrifying story. And what's terrifying about this is that it came in at a 6.33, considering that last week the show was the number one show at an 8.83. So, yes, a huge drop for Doctor Who from the very top to the very bottom in just one week. Yeah, this one, Gary, you gave it average, which was actually higher than either one of us gave it.
Yeah, so. I agree. It was a severe drop from the last episode for me as well. I mean, I understand what they're doing. They're trying to sort of go in dry and treat it like, I don't know, like history tapes or something like that. And in some sense, the framing mechanism reminded me of Blink a little bit. And I really feel that that was something that they were trying to echo to some extent. And it was not all I thought it could be. It really needed more exposition, in my opinion. I really had to scratch my head as to what was going on from certain scenes to certain scenes, who was still alive, who was dead. I never felt that anything was very clear for me as the story was unfolding. So I think it was just poor storytelling. The scenery was somewhat familiar to me. I swear I've seen those corridors before in Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
And the premise itself wasn't poor, but I really felt it was more of the framing mechanism that made this suffer. It was witty to try it and poor for not pulling it off.
Yeah, I mean, what got to me was this whole decision to go with basically, you know, a found footage episode, you know, it's not quite Blair Witch Project, but of course, you know, that's one everyone references because that kicked off this whole trend. But applying it to a story that in many ways was a quite standard Doctor Who wind up on a space station with a monster and figure out a way out of it, except I guess they wanted to try this thing of well, did it work or didn't it at the end, to try and leave a little mystery there, but to me it just fell flat. I mean, as you said, Gary, the storytelling wound up being much too haphazard and difficult to follow, and then that whole ending with the you're watching this so you've got it and you're, you know, so it's the implication that the you know, humanity ended in the 33rd century because he managed to get this out, it felt like one of those things that sounded like a good idea when they first pitched it and just didn't really work in the execution.
You want to hear what's really terrifying? This was supposed to be a two-parter. Yeah, exactly. How they thought that was going to work, I don't know, but I'm guessing they knew it wouldn't work, and that's why they decided not to make it one. Because, yeah, that's exactly the problem I had, Edmund, a lot of what you just said. I don't mind the found footage thing when it works. When it's done well, it can work very well. But in this case, it was just overly complicated how it was supposed to be working. And then just the central concept itself was just weak and needlessly disgusting, actually. It of all the villains that have been on Doctor Who in the new era that have been kind of about things that terrify you and the little things that make you think, and that it turns out to be something far more disturbing, the little gunk you get on the corner of your eye when you wake up in the morning was not something that I was thinking of.
Yeah, eye crust. Yeah,
that's yeah. Great, no, yeah. It really did nothing for me, other than go ew. But that's about it. It just was ill conceived. Mark Gatiss, what were you thinking? Please don't do anything like that on Sherlock or in any future episode of any show. Really, just avoid it. We'll all be happier. All right, that would be the bottom three for that particular week, ending the 17th of November. But we also had some in the top three. And this one, it's nice to see this show coming up in the top three after some of its scheduling travails over the last couple seasons. But Haven, Season 5, Episode 20, Just Passing Through. That's weird. Where did it go? There it is. Nathan and Vince travel back to the year 1983 in order to discover Croatoan's origins in Haven. At the same time, Duke finds himself in grave danger after being apprehended by a mysterious foe. And this one came in at an average of 8.75, which is pretty darn high for this particular show. But I have to say, for me at least, it was the fact that this seemed like just a standard episode, and then it wound up paying off a major mystery from the very beginning of the series, which I wasn't expecting to happen. So I was rather happy with the way that this episode turned out. Gary, you seem to have also been very happy with this one.
I like this episode a lot. As I like to say, they pulled out all the toys from this show and started to play with them. You know, we had Thinnies, we had time travel, we had Nathan doing an Audrey being an FBI investigator that nobody, you know, heard of before. We had the whole Croatoan thing. We had the newspaper brother figuring out his older brother who he really was, you know, pretty darn fast. I really liked this a lot. I thought it was a whole bunch of fun, and as I said they really utilized a lot of series things and brought it in. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't the necessarily a villain of the week type of show. You know, they were pulling in, like you said, you know, so many things from, even like I said, the Audrey homage that Nathan was doing through using troubles to, you know, fix other troubles. I thought it was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to me like, I mean, with six episodes left after this, that maybe they really are focusing on bringing the series to a strong conclusion, and I have my fingers crossed that they're going to pull it off, because right now it seems like they really are very focused on where they're going with things. So I'm really hopeful. All right. Moving on from there, we have the next episode in our number two slot. And this is the show that I'm sure that nobody is surprised is in this particular slot. And that is Manhattan, Season 2, Episode 6, 33. And there we are. The scientists and the army battle for control of the bomb. Ken, really?
Wow! What a novel way to twist the storyline.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. And this one came in at an average of 8.83. Gary, why don't you go ahead and get a start here?
Well, again, as we were talking about in the last episode, you know, Frank is still around and he's causing a bit of trouble. He's sending around a document to have signed because he feels that the scientists on the base should have some input into how the atomic weapon is used. And at one point, he's having everyone do signatures, and then he throws it out because he realized that it's going to be useless. Then he gets his gumption about him and gets a whole bunch of the scientists worked up as well, where they're physically going to march on the general's office, the one that made him a private, and state their case and demand things. And unfortunately, there's an unexpected twist right as this is happening. And actually, I called it, too. My wife was sitting watching the show with me, and I said, oh. And she's like, rolls her eyes like, I know it. And then when they announce it, she just sort of looks away. What happened was they announced that, President Roosevelt had passed on, which was right about that time, and that sort of put a kink into everyone's plans. So we were left sort of dangling as to what's going to happen next. But obviously, it does change things a little bit for what the driving direction of the Hill will be with a new president who, at the moment, does not know a single – nowhere even doing this research more or less, nearing completion of a bomb with it. So it should be interesting. I wonder how much more they're going to echo real-life situations as they're plotting through the storyline.
Mm. Edmund, anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, certainly that the way they're melding the historical stuff because that was a concern up on the Hill that when the scientists started realizing that they weren't having any say in where the bomb would wind up, and especially as it was getting towards the end and it was obvious that Germany was going to fall, which was a lot of them were there to prevent Hitler from getting the bomb first, and once that was obviously off the table, a lot of them did have a lot of reservations about using in the Pacific, so it's another case of them using what was actually happening historically and making some pretty good dramatic hay out of it, and of course then this twist that once Roosevelt was out of the picture and Truman was having to be basically briefed on the situation, period, and then sort of rushed towards the decision, their opportunity to have any say really was taken away from them. And also, in terms of sort of echoing real life events or current events, I should say, in a way that I wasn't really that aware of. The whole thing at the beginning of the guys in the fishing boat basically calling Pearl Harbor an inside job, and that it was something Roosevelt had just engineered to get them into the war. And it was like, oh yeah, that sounds kind of familiar to some of the current events around 9/11, et cetera, that some people keep insisting on. And just a little reminder that those sorts of sentiments and bizarre theories are something that have been around for quite a while. I thought was a nice little twist to throw in there. And of course, it led to even if you kill off an actor like Richard Schiff, it's always nice to figure out a way to bring him back. Especially just to illustrate Frank's his more fragile mental state at the moment, especially since he basically irradiates himself to get back onto the base to start his potential subversive activities. On so many levels, what was going on with that, and then with Abby and Crossley, her discovering the other espionage going on, let alone the more overt Soviet infiltrations that we've been seeing, but the fact that Crosley has been trying to make sure that the UK can still has access to this information in the bomb. Just as the series continues to do, I mean, the way they are taking these historical events, but just presenting them with some really good tension and drama and acting and writing, etc. And yes, as I said last episode, just continues to be my favorite show on right now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it certainly has earned. It's been, this episode had so many tense moments that it's earned. Show The Good Wife, Season 7, Episode 7, Driven. Alicia joins a case involving an automotive executive represented by Lockhart, Argos, and Lee, and an employee represented by Lewis Canning, who was involved in a crippling accident while test driving a car operating in driverless mode. Meanwhile, Peter moves back in with Alicia to present a United Family image in order to woo a potential campaign contributor. And this got up to an average of 9, thanks to Henry and Nadim. Nadim saying a tightly plotted and witty script make for one of the most memorable Good Wife episodes of the year. And Henry says, Alicia seems to have embraced the absurdity of her entire life. Yes, that would probably be why a show has kind of hit these high marks so consistently. But yeah, I got to say, it's been a long time since we've heard The Good Wife up in the top three. But this is why the show continues to be one that gets talked about, because the writing is just that strong. Consistently, we hear about how strong it is. So yes, and we have some of our extended Critical Myth family that is still big fans of that show. So that came in at our number one for the week of, or ending rather, the 17th of November. So yes, that is our top, and that's where we're probably going to end for right now. When we come back next episode, we're going to wrap up that episodic discussion and then see if we have time for a little bit of feedback and open topics. We'll see. It's pretty packed this week, so stay tuned.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.